Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Pearlman. Today's show will be another in my Health Challenges series. My guest is Lee Ginnenthal. Ginnenthal is a special ed teacher in the Ithaca City School District and the owner of DeRosenmeister Nursery. In 2010, he was diagnosed with prostate cancer, and we'll talk about how he has navigated this often baffling disease. Ginnenthal is an ongoing participant in the Prostate Cancer Support Group and the Men's Breakfast Group at the Cancer Resource Center of the Finger Lakes. And welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
I want to talk about the fact that you were diagnosed with prostate cancer in May of 2010, and this was a process that started just after you had just had a normal physical. And so tell us what happened. Your physical showed an elevated PSA. Tell us what that means and what prostate cancer really is.
Sure. I had gone in for my annual physical. It was probably the end of summer, so August 2009. And prior to that, my physician had not recommended doing PSA screenings because a lot of physicians had been advised that it leads to a lot of false positives. Mm-hmm. But within the past year, she had one of her patients diagnosed with prostate cancer, and she was very concerned that she hadn't caught it. So she wanted me to have a PSA test.
Wow, lucky.
I figured, okay, you know, no big deal. Won't be a problem. And then I get the results, and she said, this is suspicious. I want you to see the urologist.
Wow. So you weren't having any symptoms. This was totally out of the blue.
Totally asymptomatic. I was 56. Everything was fine, I thought.
Wow. That is lucky that you had a doctor who thought to do that.
For sure.
So it's a chance. Well, tell us what happened after that. I mean, you end up having to go to a urologist.
So, yeah, within a month, I saw a urologist, and they want to be very cautious. They don't want to jump right in and act right away. So he wanted to rule out a whole host of things that could cause elevated levels of PSA. PSA stands for prostate-specific antigen, and it can be a marker for something amiss in the prostate. It could be inflammation of the prostate, like prostatitis, or it could be more serious, like prostate cancer. So we spent the next 9 months ruling out all kinds of things, trying various courses of antibiotic, doing cystoscopes where they took a look in my bladder, just ongoing checking. And through that time, he continued to monitor my PSA every 3 months, and it would go up. It would go down a little, it would go up, but generally the movement was up, which led him finally to say, you know, I think we're at the point where we should do a biopsy.
Mm, that must have scared you.
For sure, because I kept thinking, oh, okay, you know, one course of antibiotics, it's just prostatitis.
Yeah.
And what was interesting is I had had prostatitis when I was a young man in my early 20s, but no recurrence of it. So then I went in for the needle biopsy, which was done in the office, and he said, oh, you know, this isn't that bad of a procedure. It'll be okay. You'll just feel a little sharp poke. Well, the needle biopsy is done through your rectum. So they have a tube with a needle on the end, and they poke through your colon into the prostate.
Oh, my gosh.
They typically take 3 samples from each quadrant of the prostate. The prostate is about the size of
a walnut. Yeah.
And the sample is about a little less than a centimeter, and a centimeter is about the size of an eraser on a pencil.
That's a big sample.
Tell me about it.
But they give you anesthesia or they don't give you a local a spinal
nothing.
Or anything? Really?
Yeah. What I found out afterwards is that some folks ask for a Valium or something just to relax them. And, you know, he said it was nothing, so I thought I would be fine. And it was uncomfortable. I wouldn't say it was terrible pain, but it was very uncomfortable. With the sonogram that he was doing at the same time, he ended up noticing a tumor that he didn't pick up on when he had done the digital exam. So he ended up taking a 13th sample, and the 13th sample was from the tumor.
Oh,
and when we got the results, the cancer was in that 13th sample. If he hadn't seen it with the sonogram, he could have just taken the 12 and said, oh, everything looks fine.
Wow.
Another interesting thing was also in, I must have been in my mid-20s, I had gone for a physical, and the doctor commented when he did a digital exam that my prostate felt as if it was asymmetrical and it was something I should keep an eye on. He ended up leaving the area, and no doctor after that noticed that, and I would always tell them, you know, this doctor said that. Well, it turns out where the tumor was where the asymmetry had been detected.
Wow.
Probably 35 years before.
Wow. And that just tells you that people do have to advocate on their own behalf to make sure that they get the correct and the right kind of exam.
Sure.
Wow. So I understood from what you told me that after you were diagnosed with prostate cancer, you had three different opinions. One said, just wait and see what happens. The other one said, you know, you should not wait more than a few months, but then you should have surgery. Weren't you totally confused by all this?
Oh, for sure. In fact, it was even before I got to any of the second or third opinion, it was very confusing. I spoke to my urologist and I said, well, what do you recommend? He said, well, you'll have to choose from a menu of things. You know, the options for treatment include radiation, which could be external beam radiation or seed implant. The options could also be surgery, which could be open procedure where they open through the abdomen, or they could do laparoscopic. There's also hormone therapy, but that's usually used for more advanced cases.
Mm. And they have the patient decide this, or does the doctor usually recommend one or the other?
Well, they sort of recommend, but it's a joint decision. And when I asked him about the research behind treatment approaches, he said they all come up with about the same results. And then I said, well, what about a second opinion? Wouldn't that clear it up? And he said, well, if I sent you to a radiologist, they'd say to do radiation. If I sent you to a surgeon, they'd say to do surgery.
My God.
So you're kind of left with, what do I do? He had suggested with my age that I go the surgery route if I was going to go for treatment. I didn't fit the typical profile for the watchful waiting or what's called active surveillance because I was 56. Mm-hmm. If I was 60 or 65, I would have fit the recommendations. But he thought it was still not as pervasive through the prostate and that I could probably get away with that. But along with that, I would have had to go through biopsies every 6 to 9 months.
Oh, my God.
And I asked him, so if I did this, would I eventually have to have the surgery? And he said, probably. I said, then why wait? And he said, well, it's a quality of life issue.
Oh, my God. And you didn't have any symptoms, right? I mean, it seems to me that some of the medical decisions would be based on whether you did, you know.
Sure.
Trouble urinating, blood, mm-hmm. you know, erectile
no
dysfunction.
Large prostate, nothing.
Those are some of the symptoms I've heard about.
Yeah. He never went into much detail about what he meant by quality of life and that would be impacted. It was interesting, these euphemisms that we use. So in my case, he said to go with the surgery first because if you start with radiation and the cancer recurs, you can't do surgery after that.
Really?
You just go straight to hormone therapy. If you do surgery and the cancer recurs, you can do radiation, and then you can also do hormone therapy.
Mm.
It's interesting now, many years ago when I was a little boy, one of my great-great uncles had prostate cancer, and the treatment in those days was castration.
You're kidding me.
Yeah. Because one of the things that feeds the prostate cancer is testosterone. What they've developed these days is hormone therapy that eliminates the production of testosterone.
Yeah, which totally destroys your sex life as well, right?
For sure.
God,
there's all
the
kinds of side effects that come with it.
Yeah.
There's enlarged breast development. There's loss of muscle mass. Loss of bone density, all these kind of things.
Wow. And then they tell you that, right? I mean, do they give you that information or do you have to go look it up on the internet?
Generally, they'll tell you. They'll give you a brochure. They'll hit the high points and then there's the brochure and then there's the books you start reading.
Uh-huh.
And then you go online.
So, you know, this is exactly why people need to be informed. You know, you cannot just expect medical people to be up front, number one, or know everything, number two, right? I mean, that's just amazing to me. So you chose the laparoscopic surgery, what they call it, right? To tell us how that worked and what it did and if it cured you, I mean, in some way.
What happens with the advantage to the laparoscopic is that you're not cutting through abdominal muscle. So they make five small incisions. They have robotic arms that go through these little holes. The surgeon is sitting on the opposite side of the room, strapped into a computer console. He's not even near you. He's not even looking at you directly. He's looking at a screen like he's playing some kind of online game.
Wow.
You're strapped to the table. You're inverted. They inflate your stomach with air to make more space. In one of the little openings, they put a little fiber optic camera and light. They have these little robotic arms with their handy-dandy little hands and scalpels that go in. And the advantage to this is that with a robotic cutting tool, they can go in 360 degrees. A human hand can't go at that level. The other thing is when he's sitting at the console, the images are magnified so he can see very well what's going on. In this procedure, the prostate surrounds the urethra. The urethra goes into the bladder, and the prostate's located on the bottom of the bladder. So they section off the urethra above and below the prostate. So they're taking out a section of your urethra.
Wow.
They put a catheter in your urethra, and then they pull the what's left of urethra below the prostate up, and they stitch it to the bladder. Now, along with this, they end up taking the sphincter off your bladder.
Oh.
So sphincter is a fast-twitch, automatic muscle. You end up having to learn how to train other muscles to control your bladder.
Wow.
Now
we're going to talk about that, too, the rehab after this.
Sure. Yeah. The other thing is when they initially did prostate cancer surgery, they would open you up and they would just cut top and bottom and remove the prostate. The prostate is covered with bundles of nerves on either side.
Oh.
When you cut those nerves, what you've effectively done is eliminated any nerve impulse between the bladder and the penis. So you lose the ability to have an erection, and you lose the ability to be continent. You wet yourself, and there's no way you can control it. So they've developed what they call nerve-sparing surgery. That was developed down in Johns Hopkins. And they were doing that with an open procedure. And very carefully, they pare away the nerve bundles from the side of the prostate.
That's amazing that they finally learned how to do that, right?
It's a big quality of life issue.
I would think that it would be.
So in what they try to do is this nerve-sparing procedure. In my situation, the tumor was on one side of the prostate, right up against where a nerve bundle was. Oftentimes, prostate cancer can spread through nerve cells. So they removed a section of the nerves on one side of the prostate, and they did a biopsy on those as well. So I had what was called a partial nerve-sparing procedure.
Mm.
Then when the prostate is removed, they've got the catheter and they attach the urethra. The prostate kind of drops into your abdomen and they take it out through a like a 1-inch incision just below your navel.
Wow. We will continue talking about this. If you're just joining us, my guest is Lee Ginnenthal. We're talking with him on one of our Health Challenges series shows, and we're talking about prostate cancer. Now, talk to us a little bit about the rehab that you have to go through after this. That sounds like a tremendous challenge as well.
Sure. I'm a teacher, and when I need information, I research and teach myself. What I found out was that in addition to rehab, you need to do prehab. And at that point, it was fairly new in treatment of prostate cancer surgery. Luckily, the wife of the principal I was working with at that point was a physical therapist who specialized in pelvic floor therapy and was just starting to develop her practice with men.
Wow.
So I went to see her, and she recommended some exercises to strengthen the pelvic floor and the muscles that you end up having to use when you no longer have a sphincter to control it. Mm. Those muscles also help with maintaining an erection or getting an erection. So I started with the prehab, and then after the surgery, pretty much the doctors will say, you know, when the surgery is done, they're done with you. Some of the surgeons are more forward-thinking. The surgeon I went to was, and one of the things that they do is they will prescribe a vacuum pump that you'll use, because initially you're not having any erections on your own because the nerves are traumatized.
Yeah.
And if you don't get blood to the penis, the tissue starts to atrophy and shrink.
Wow. And I can't believe they don't try to help you with this before it happens. And then do you think doctors are just embarrassed? Are they ill-informed, or they don't want to deal with it? Or
I think the patients are uncomfortable. I think they think that their job is to treat the cancer. And when the cancer is done, they've done what they needed to do. And they tend not to look at folks as whole people.
Yeah, yeah. I want to ask you this, too, but before I forget. Once you've had this surgery, how much of a healing period is there? You know, worrying about infection and stuff.
Okay.
Before you can even start rehab.
Sure. You have a catheter in for about 10 days to 2 weeks, and then the catheter is removed. They leave that in there just to be sure that the urethra is well attached to the bladder before they remove it. Uh-huh. At that point, you're walking around with a catheter bag, and it's pretty uncomfortable. That was almost one of the most uncomfortable things after the surgery. Mm. Because they didn't cut through any stomach muscle, I wasn't having those kind of pains. There were some pains inside. There were, it could be referred to as like a phantom pain, where the prostate had been, where it was removed. Uh-huh. I felt this dull ache that was pretty constant for quite a while.
Wow.
But it was the catheter that was the most uncomfortable thing.
Uh-huh.
When they removed it, they told me I was not going to have bladder control for a while and that I needed to bring one of those adult Depends with me to the office. So they take the catheter out, and I figured, oh, okay, well, you know, when I have to go to the bathroom, you know, I'll leak some. Well, immediately urine started coming out.
Oh, dear.
I was shocked. Now, I had this idea after that appointment. My wife and I were going to go out to lunch and maybe stop off at a store, you know, because I would feel like I could walk around. I didn't feel much like walking around. And the thought of wearing a diaper, the feeling of wearing a diaper,
yeah,
soaking myself, I said, let's get in the car. I just want to go home.
Yeah, yeah. So you were able to rehab after this. Did,
sure.
Did it take a long time? And obviously you recommend that men find out about this.
Oh, for sure. So initially it was the Kegel exercises and pelvic floor strengthening, doing those off and on throughout the day, a lot of walking. They had me walking probably within 12 hours of the surgery.
Mm.
They had me up walking the unit, and I was discharged within 24 hours of the surgery. Within a week, I was walking a mile or a mile and a half a day. Within 2 weeks, I was hiking up Treman Gorge from lower to upper and back down.
Wow.
Because I was determined that I was not going to just sit.
Yeah. And you wanted to resume your normal life, and you knew that was out there, right? I mean, it's,
yeah,
it's obviously doable.
That was a key thing.
Yeah.
Along with that, what they also provide prescriptions for, things like Viagra or Cialis, and that was started probably about a month after the surgery.
Mm-hmm.
One of the other things that can be done are penile injections. With the pill, it allows the release of certain chemicals in the penis that help get an erection with stimulation.
Mm-hmm.
With the injection, you get the erection within 10 minutes without any contact or anything.
There's another reason not to go out of the house for a while.
The other thing that happens is the erection stays for 45 minutes to an hour, even after you have an orgasm.
Wow.
The idea of sticking a needle in your penis is pretty traumatic, but when you want to have sexual relations, and that's going to make the difference, you go ahead and do it.
I'm sure people would do anything for that.
Yeah,
right?
I had been talking to other men online in prostate cancer support groups about this penile rehab. And what they were finding is that the sooner you do it, the better it is.
Ah.
So I spoke to my local urologist and my surgeon, and I kept pushing for a prescription for the injections. They said, it's too soon, it's too soon. We won't even talk about this for 6 months. At 6 months, they said, we don't want to talk about it for till a year.
Oh, my God.
So it was a year that I waited. And now many urologists and surgeons are recommending within 2 or 3 weeks after the surgery that you start injections.
Yeah. You know, men have got to be actively involved in this. That's what this is telling me.
Sure.
Wow, Lee, that's amazing.
Yeah. The other thing that ends up happening is that guys are embarrassed to go up to the druggist and get a prescription for something like Cialis or Viagra.
Yeah.
And, you know, folks see ads for it on TV and they scoff. You know, they make comments about horny old men or dirty old men. Well, you know, sex is a part of our lives,
yeah,
even when we're old.
Exactly. And it's, you know, I mean, it is important for somebody who's gone through a traumatic physical event like this, you know. I mean, we're not talking about dirty old men. We're talking about men who want to be healthy, right?
Right.
Gosh. Oh, it's amazing how complicated prostate cancer can be. I mean,
sure.
Obviously, I didn't know all the complications that could happen. Well, tell us what happens after that. So you go through this and you get back to normal life. How often do you have to be checked? Are you constantly worried, you know, any little symptom that something's
sure.
going on?
Initially, your PSA levels are checked every 3 months. At the end of about 9 months or so, they say, okay, let's go to a six-month check.
Mm.
And then after that, you graduate to yearly checks if your PSA is undetectable. The doctor assured me that after the surgery, they got it all. It looked pretty clear that he didn't think it had spread. Everything would be fine. So I felt great. Everything's okay. And I would go for the blood test. And, you know, you go at the hospital and then you have the appointment with the urologist. And they'd say, well, are you nervous about this? And I'd say, no. But after I would get the results each time, it would feel like there was such a weight that came off my shoulders.
Uh-huh.
Even though chances are everything was going to be fine, you still have this nagging suspicion and doubt.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just had my last PSA blood test in February. And even then, 5.5 years out, there was this, oh, boy.
Relief.
Yeah, and then you want to just take a nap.
Yeah. but are there risks after you go through this surgery and they don't detect anything in the lymph nodes or spreading anywhere? Is there a risk that you still could have cancer pop up from that?
For sure.
From that original?
There's quite a risk. There are men in our area that are part of our local prostate cancer support group who went through the same procedure as I did. And when they got to their three-month checkup, things looked okay. It wasn't totally undetectable, but it was very low. And then six-month checkup, all of a sudden the PSA started rising. So one of my friends, we end up creating this brotherhood, you know, of men who have joined this club that they didn't choose to join.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But we become this brotherhood that's there for each other. He's now on this journey where he's faced with hormone therapy, radiation, and it appears as though the hormone therapy is working. His PSA levels are dropping. But in his situation now, they ended up finding a spot on the pubic bone.
Oh, dear.
And they found a spot on one of the lymph nodes.
So when this comes back, you have to be really aggressive. It sounds like it.
You have to be vigilant.
It can be very deadly, yeah.
But now with radiation and hormone therapy, it's not the death sentence that it used to be.
Yeah.
They're getting more years in your life and more quality in the years that you have.
I want to ask you this. What advice would you have for a man who just recently got diagnosed? What is the first thing he should probably do? Find support? Do research?
The research is kind of tricky because when you go online, you're going to be totally overwhelmed with the volume of information. And you're going to have folks that are going to tell you, oh, you can cure this with diet or with this extract. And then there are going to be folks that are going to say you immediately need to do this, that, or the other thing. So in our situation here in Ithaca, we're lucky. We have the Cancer Resource Center of the Finger Lakes. I went in there within a week of my being diagnosed. And Bob Ritter, the director, sat down with me, gave me a packet of materials with a list of which websites to check out.
Ah.
One of the most reliable ones that I would recommend is a website called Us2, T-O-O.
Mm.
There are support groups on there, and there's information that's accurate and updated. So I would narrow my search to just one or two places.
Yeah. I always recommend the Mayo Clinic. Too,
yeah, that's another good one.
Yeah.
The other thing is talk to men who have gone through the procedure. Don't make immediate decisions. When you go to the doctor, have another set of ears there to be listening. Because as soon as someone says the word cancer, you no longer hear anything else.
Yeah. So you think people should really go to the Cancer Resource Center here in town or wherever they are?
Sure.
There's cancer resource centers all mm-hmm. over the country now.
Sure. Us2 has a list of patient advocacy groups throughout the country, so you could find that on their website.
Uh-huh. We only have a couple of minutes left. Tell us more about the cancer resource centers, the groups, and you said that you go to breakfasts. And
sure.
So it is a real brotherhood. And how often do you meet?
The breakfasts are every Friday morning. The past few months, I haven't been a regular attendee. Initially, I was there every single Friday. I made time for it. And what I found was that it was important to be with other folks who had cancer, not necessarily prostate cancer. And we don't often talk about cancer. But you need to be in an environment where somebody's not going to be asking those well-meaning questions that are just off the mark or giving you that sad look or telling you, you know, keep that stiff upper lip. Oh, you're an inspiration for all the rest of us.
Yeah.
You just need to hang out with some folks that understand.
Yeah.
When we have a new member that come to the group, we do what's called our organ recital. We each go around and we say what kind of cancer we had, what our treatment was, and where we're at.
So this isn't just for prostate cancer. This
right.
is men just with cancer
sure.
in general.
Then there's a prostate cancer support group. Periodically, we'll meet. At one point, we were meeting monthly, but now we come together just when there's somebody newly diagnosed who needs to talk to a group of folks. And what's nice about it is that it's men and their partners. Whether you have a female or a male partner,
uh-huh.
the partners are there because they're impacted by these decisions.
Oh, absolutely.
So some of our time is spent in a mixed group with the men and their partners, and sometimes the partners will sit by themselves and talk about issues that they have.
Wow, well, this is great. Can you give us any contact information or resource information people can get in touch with?
If you go online, the web address for the Cancer Resource Center is crcfl.org.
Great. Well, Lee Ginnenhall, thank you so much for joining us. It's been so wonderful for you to share this with us because this information needs to be out there. And I thank you for being so open and able to talk to us so articulately. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.